Bryson.
I don't think they'll try.
And that's the warning.
I hope.
People just.
Yeah.
That chip on his shoulder.
Well, oh yeah.
We're just sitting here like, Jesus.
Why?
Yeah, but this is just the warning.
Oh.
Yeah. That's what's creepy.
I know.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what's
creepy. I got it.
I just haven't read it.
The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Senior Airman Gerard Simmons, number ACM 39342. In today's oral argument, we consider whether it was plain error for the military judge to allow the prosecution to introduce evidence of appellant's pre-service sexual relationships with the alleged victims, and whether the military judge allowed the prosecution to make a major change over defense objection. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. We'd like to reserve 7 minutes, please.
Very well. You may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Senior Judge Johnson, members of the court. My name is Zachary Spillman. Major Schwartz and I represent the appellant, Senior Airman Simmons. May it please the court. In this member's case, it was plain and obvious error for the military judge to allow the prosecution to use appellant's pre-service sexual activities with the alleged victims to characterize him as a manipulative, violent, predatory pedophile, and to encourage the members to convict him in order to ensure that he is punished, even if he is innocent of the charged offenses. The prosecution did that in this case by bookending the trial with references to, quote, two different periods of Senior Airman Simmons' life. Those are the words of the trial counsel that were used during the opening statement. It's record at 174. And the trial counsel continued during the opening. The first period is before he joined the Air Force. Now, the Air Force can't do anything to him for anything that he may have done at that time. The Air Force can't try him in court. They can't punish him for any of that. That's record at 174 to 175. Now, that's one bookend. The other was in closing argument when the trial counsel said, now, you know he joined the Air Force on 20 August 2013. Again, anything before this date is not being tried for. He will not be punished for. That was record at 432. Of course, that wasn't true. Appellant actually was punished for the things that happened before he joined the Air Force. In particular, one of his alleged victims, A.S., who was 14 years old when she met him and began a sexual relationship with him, and this is before he joined the Air Force. So they met while he was still in high school. She was in high school. They began a sexual relationship, and then he joined the Air Force. She testified that he knew her true age. She claimed on direct examination by the trial counsel that one day she and appellant were talking about her age and the sexual nature of their relationship, and that appellant said to her that the youngest girl he would have sex with is someone who's 12 years old. Again, A.S. was clear that that conversation, in her testimony, she was clear that that conversation occurred before appellant joined the Air Force. Nevertheless, after he was convicted during the sentencing phase of the court-martial, the trial counsel told the members, you have the opportunity here today to protect society from someone who does that. And bear in mind, when you're considering protection of society, that the accused said the youngest girl he would have sex with is 12 years old. 12 years old. Protect society, confine him for at least 12 years. And the members adjudged precisely that sentence. So the error in this case is a violation of one of the most basic precepts of American jurisprudence, that an accused must be convicted based only on evidence of the crime before the court, not based on evidence of a general criminal disposition. The crime before the court in this case was primarily sexual activity with two girls, CL and AS, both of whom were under the age of 16. There was some ancillary misconduct, but the real focus of the case was the sexual activity with these two girls. The fact that appellant had had sexual relationships with each of them prior to joining the Air Force was not relevant to any matter in issue for those offenses. It did not prove any element of any offense. It did not disprove any of the defenses, and it did not make it more likely that appellant committed the charged acts. The fact that he had had sex with them before did not make it more probable that he had sex with them after joining the Air Force.
Counsel, let me ask you about that. If one of the charges that the government was required to prove had to do with the allegation that appellant essentially extorted CL using a picture that he had taken during a prior sexual act, wouldn't the fact that such acts occurred be relevant to prove that offense?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. So the fact that the extortion allegation was that he extorted her using a picture of her performing oral sex on him. So you really have three parts there towards the factual nature of the offense as alleged in the specification, that there was a picture, that it showed her performing oral sex, and that it was on him. They probably needed to prove a picture, right? They needed to prove something that was used for the extortion, but they didn't have to prove that it showed her performing oral sex. They didn't have to prove that it was oral sex on him. And in fact, they didn't have to prove that it occurred pre-service. Now, we're dealing with a situation where the defense failed.
I'm sorry. Yes, sir. Can you clarify that last statement, that they didn't have to prove that it occurred pre-service? Like, are you suggesting they could just admit it without any discussion, that it's the discussion that matters?
So the photo was never admitted, Your Honor, right? So there was no actual photo produced at trial. All there was some testimony about a photo that CL, she is the one who said she saw the photo, saw at some point, and then references in Facebook message exchanges and other electronic message exchanges to a picture or pictures. And so from that, the implication was he is coercing her into continuing the sexual relationship by threatening to publicize this image. The nature of the image, not that important, right? Now, we acknowledge that the nature of the image was probably likely to come out in one form or another. I mean, it's just practical reality that they would have to, you know, they can outline the image, but they're going to end up coloring in the picture as the trial goes along. But what happened in this case went way beyond that. And I'd like to illustrate it with an example involving CL. So CL and appellant were in high school together. They met in class together before appellant joined the Air Force. They began an on and off again sexual relationship that primarily consisted of CL performing oral sex on appellant. And then ultimately, appellant was convicted of two offenses involving CL. One instance of oral sex after he joined the Air Force, and the extortion for threatening to publicize the picture that we were just talking about. Now, during CL's direct examination, the prosecution elicited extensive testimony from her about her pre-service sexual activities with appellant and about the nature of their pre-service sexual relationship. The trial counsel then summarized all of that during closing argument. And the summary was accurate with her testimony. I'd like to read just a section of it. So the trial counsel says in argument, so fall 2012, he, appellant, meets CL in Spanish class. You heard her talk about that, Miss V's class. And he talks with her, he pays her a little attention. Now she's not used to that. She's never had a boyfriend, she told you that. And he's her first kiss, you heard about that in the hallway. He pulls her into a stairwell, under a stairwell, and you heard what happens next. Without saying a word, he pulls down his pants, he pulls out his penis. She was embarrassed, she was unsure of what was happening. She told you she saw his penis, she said it was flaccid, it was the first time she saw one. And he tried to get her to pull her hand to him and touch it, but she wouldn't. She pushed him away, she didn't want to do that, but he kept after her. Now that, the testimony from CL, the evidence of the pre-service sexual activity, that was an accurate summary of her testimony. She testified about all that stuff. But what it did was it introduced into the court-martial wholly irrelevant principles, wholly irrelevant things, such as force, non-consent, manipulation, pursuit, vulnerability of the alleged victim, all of these factors that were wholly irrelevant to prove the charged offenses. Now, Judge Dennis, you might think, well, what about the extortion, right? The extortion involves some degree of coercion or manipulation or vulnerability, but all of this occurred before any photo was taken, right? All of these acts predate even the existence of the photograph, never mind the existence of jurisdiction or the existence of something that he could be punished for, and that was the problem. The military judge never determined the purpose for which the pre-service acts were allowed to be introduced. She did not rule that they were evidence of knowledge, plan, preparation, or any other MRE 404B factor.
But didn't she say specifically that they were not admissible for propensity?
In the end, Your Honor, she said that she refused to give a propensity instruction. So the prosecution never asked or gave notice of a 414 use of this evidence. In the end, when they were discussing instructions, sort of ironically, on page 414 of the record, the prosecution says, hey, we'd like a propensity instruction. The military judge says, no, I'm not going to give that, in part because she did not use the words, but she verbalizes what appears to be a 403 balancing, that based on how the offenses were charged, the propensity instruction, and how the case had unfolded, the propensity instruction would be unfairly prejudicial. Because his propensity wasn't an issue. You know, the defense was that he wouldn't have done that, was not that he would not have done this. The defense was, for CL, that they stopped having sexual activity when he learned of the age of consent under the UCMJ as 16. And there's evidence in the record, we put it in the brief, of when that happened and a contemporaneous exchange of messages between appellant and CL saying, hey, we can't have sexual activity anymore, words to that effect. The defense for AS was that he didn't know her age, that he thought she was older. So the fact that he would have been willing or that he wouldn't have necessarily been turned away by the fact that she was under 16 was not an issue in this case. The defense conceded that he knew CL was under 16, and they conceded that the sexual activity with AS occurred. It just goes to his actual knowledge of their ages, of AS's age.
Even if the defense concedes something, the government still has to make a prima facie case, correct? I mean, a defense counsel's concession is an evidence.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that, but propensity doesn't prove an element. And this is another interesting piece about the 414 instruction, right? Because 414 could perhaps be seen as sort of a safety, a fallback position in this case. Well, okay, it wasn't admissible under 404B, it wasn't admissible to prove an element, but couldn't it have been admissible under 414? We don't think so for the reasons I've just discussed, and we think that the military judge ultimately held it wasn't admissible under 414, but even if it was, it would have come with instructions. And one of those instructions would have said that you can't use propensity to make up for a failure of proof on one of the actual elements, that propensity is not a substitute for evidence of guilt. Right back to the point I made at the beginning, that propensity does not alleviate the prosecution of its burden to win a conviction based on evidence of the crime before the court, not evidence of general criminal disposition. There was no such instruction in this case. There was no instruction at all. There was the boilerplate, you can't convict him based on general criminal disposition.
Did the defense ask for such an instruction?
They didn't, Your Honor. And that's, so the defense didn't ask for a lot of stuff that at this point we wish they would have asked for. We accept that the punishment for that is the plain error standard. We accept that we have a heightened burden to prove the existence of an error, the fact that the error was plain or obvious, and the prejudice. Frankly, we believe that had there been a timely objection, this evidence would have been kept out, and Senior Airman Simmons would not have been convicted. So,
on the subject of standards, I would like to ask you, is this a constitutional error?
So we think it is, Your Honor. For the reasons outlined in the brief, you know, we've pointed specifically to the case law that says that the right to be convicted only on the basis of evidence of guilt as opposed to propensity or criminal disposition affects due process.
But surely not every evidentiary error is constitutional. I mean, the cases are pretty clear on that.
Right. And we agree with that, Your Honor. And not every improper argument is going to raise a constitutional concern. A good example of this perhaps is Ahern. Right, so Ahern has a lot of applicability to this case because Ahern's also a waiver case. And in Ahern, you had a procedural waiver. There's an MRE that says that if you don't object to this prior to entry of pleas, you have waived any error from this. And on appeal, the defense asserted an error based on the MRE. The rule, I'm sorry, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but the rule is the one that says that you can't infer an admission of guilt from an accused's silence when he doesn't deny an allegation that's made to him. And the argument on appeal was that the trial counsel had, in closing argument, inferred guilt from his silence. The question was, you know, you did this, didn't you? And he didn't say anything.
Right, the right to remain silent. I don't think there would be any debate about the constitutional implications of the right to remain silent and how that plays out. This is a little bit different, though, isn't it?
Well, no, Your Honor, I'm actually arguing that that was not a constitutional issue, right? In Ahern, it was merely the inference that can be drawn. It wasn't about his right to remain silent because he was being questioned by a third party. He wasn't being questioned by law enforcement. The entirety of the exchange was admitted. He didn't remain silent. He had an exchange. He just didn't respond to that allegation. And so the inference that the rule of evidence discusses is, can you infer guilt from that? And there was a decision from the Army Court in that case that analyzed how you apply that particular rule, but CAF said it was waived because they didn't object. They didn't raise the issue prior to entry of pleas, and that's a procedural waiver. That was not a constitutional issue. This is a constitutional issue. And the difference is that in Ahern, they were just talking about an inference, an application of a rule of evidence. Here we're talking about changing the very nature of the trial, changing it from, did he commit the discrete acts that are alleged on the charge sheet, to, is he somebody who has a sexual interest in children that needs to be punished? Is he somebody who would have sex with a child as young as 12 and so deserves 12 years of confinement for it? In other words, you know, we cite in, I think, the reply brief, Old Chief versus United States, which is a Supreme Court case from 1997. And in Old Chief, the court was really looking at 403 balancing, right? Whether the probative value of evidence of Old Chief's prior convictions involving firearms and violence was outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And Justice Souter, writing for the court, explained that unfair prejudice within its context means an undue tendency to suggest decision on an improper basis, commonly though not necessarily an emotional one. And that's what we have here, is a suggestion to convict on an improper basis that may or may not be founded in emotion, but is not based on the evidence of the crimes that were charged. Justice Souter's opinion continued, such improper grounds certainly include the one that Old Chief points to here. Generalizing a defendant's earlier bad act into bad character and taking that as raising the odds that he did the later bad act now charged, or worse, as calling for preventative conviction even if he should happen to be innocent momentarily. As then Judge Breyer put it, and this is still from the opinion in Old Chief, although propensity evidence is relevant, the risk that a jury will convict for crimes other than those charged, or that uncertain of guilt, it will convict anyway because a bad person deserves punishment, creates a prejudicial effect that outweighs ordinary relevance. And that's what we have here. Over and over again, the trial counsel told the members, we're telling you about lots of bad stuff he did for which he won't be punished. And then they presented a weak case on the merits. And then in the end, they came back and said, now, he's not going to get punished for all that other bad stuff that everyone concedes that he did. So you have to find him guilty now.
Mr. Spillman, I'd like you to move to the next issue regarding the major change. And I'd like you to address not only why you believe it's a major change, but if we determine that it's a minor change, I'd like your position on the military judge's failure to discuss prejudice when the judge ruled that the change could happen.
So I think my answer is going to blur your two questions, Your Honor.
That's fine.
So the preferred specification alleged extortion on diverse occasions between August 2nd of 2014 and December 31 of 2014. So the last 40% of the year. The changed specification alleged extortion, again on diverse occasions, between 27 October 2013 and 31 December 2013. So that nearly tripled the time period in which this occurred by moving the start date way up, making it much earlier. The defense objected, the change was allowed, and the members convicted Senior Airman Simmons of the specification as changed. So we can't know when the alleged, or when the acts that formed the basis for the conviction occurred, or even how many there were, except to say that there was more than one, because they convicted him of diverse occasions. Now, there are two primary reasons why The change to that specification was a major change that added a matter that was not fairly included in the spec as originally charged. The first is how it nearly tripled the time period. By expanding the time period so much, it not only surprised the defense, but it creates an ambiguous finding, because you can't now know what evidence the members relied on to convict him. The second is that the charge did unfairly surprise the defense, and I think that this touches on the prejudice question you asked, Judge Lewis, because the on-again, off-again nature of the relationship that appellant had with CL, the time basis, or because of that on-again, off-again basis of the relationship, the time period for the extortion charge was an important element. The lack of communications and the lack of interactions between appellant and CL in 2014 was the linchpin of the defense. Right? They did not get back together. They did not have more sexual activity after, so the defense said after he joined the Air Force, but certainly after the New Year's 2013-14. So the December 31, 2013 encounter of which he was convicted, all of the evidence really supports that there was no further physical contact between them after that date. There was some electronic communications in the record, but the defense's position was all they had at that time was electronic communications. And so by bringing back the start date of the extortion allegation, of the specification, to encompass things long before the time period where the defense, at the beginning of trial, the defense knew all the evidence is going to show they weren't together. There was very little communication. You know, we've got this one, they say. And then during trial, midstream, during the presentation of evidence, the prosecution says, we want to change these dates and bring it much earlier. That implicates a surprise, a significant surprise, a significant change to the specification. And so that not only makes it a major change, but that's the prejudice as well, that they were not prepared to defend an allegation that went back that far in time.
What about the alleged prejudice that was introduced at trial, or that was argued by trial defense counsel, regarding her age, regarding the fact that she was younger because of the time frame?
So we think that matters. The problem is that creates a sentencing issue, and it ties back to the introduction of the pre-service conduct. So some of the pre-service activity that was introduced involved that picture. And so the members had already been exposed to pre-service sexual activity or sexual activity with CL when she was much younger. The incremental, it's hard for us now to argue that incremental increase in prejudice tipped the balance and made this change prejudicial. We think that this change was prejudicial because it was an improper major change and because it surprised them. We think that the fact of all of that prior sexual activity coming in, that was prejudicial on its own. So I don't know how well I've answered your question, Your Honor, but it's a factor, but it's not the thing that we're leading with. It's not the reason that we think that this was an improper change.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to the first point you made with regard to this being a major change to make sure I understand your argument. So you said that this resulted in a more ambiguous finding. How is that different in this case from any other case that's charged on diverse occasions?
Because of the way the change came out. I mean, the issue in this case is that midstream in trial, after the witnesses had testified, they said, hey, you know, this testimony, and I see that my time's about to expire, if I may continue, Your Honor.
You may.
Thank you. They said, hey, this testimony doesn't line up with the dates that we've charged. We want to charge different. We want to change the dates. We want to charge a different defense. We failed to prove the one we charged. That's fundamentally what the trial counsel asked and the judge allowed. And the problem is they didn't move at all to the left. Right? They left the original end date in place. They just moved the start date. And so.
But they didn't change the players, right? They didn't change who the victim was. They didn't change the nature of the offense. Insofar as like the alleged misconduct, right? They didn't change that.
I agree in part. The fact there were in the original charge time period, there were communications between the accused and CL. But there was no in-person interaction. And that forms a very, our position is that forms a very factually, if not legally, weak, if not outright insufficient basis for an extortion charge. Right? Just because he talked to her about this picture doesn't mean that he was extorting her in any way. And so when they moved it earlier to encompass, the prosecution originally believed that there was going to be a meeting, that they had met up after that communication. At trial, CL testified that they didn't. And so they had to shift it earlier to encompass an earlier in-person meeting. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Government counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Senior Judge Johnson, members of the court. Captain Peter Kellett, along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States in this proceeding. This court should deny appellant's claim for relief because his claim of error as to his pre-service sexual acts was waived during trial, and even if they weren't waived, there was no plain error. In regards to issue two, the change to the specification was minor. I want to first discuss issue one, and briefly, I understand that the issue for our argument focuses on whether or not it was plain error, but just briefly, because it kind of is intertwined with the reasons why the judge did not have a sua sponte duty to instruct, go over some of the reasons why trial defense counsel waived the issue. First, trial defense counsel did not respond to the motion that trial counsel filed prior to the initial 39A session, where trial counsel alerted the court and defense counsel that he wanted to admit this evidence. Also, when asked about not filing a motion or a response to the motion, trial defense counsel responded there was no objection. He also didn't object in opening statement during trial on the merits or during findings argument to the references to these pre-service sexual acts, and he never requested a limiting instruction. And finally, defense counsel explained the reasoning for why he thought it would be admissible to begin with on pages 413 through 414 of the record, saying that it was admissible as facts and circumstances. And moving into the plain error analysis, some of those reasons I'll bring up again under the plain error analysis. But first of all, under the first prong of the analysis, it was not error. And the military judge understood the evidence to be facts and circumstances, and she explained as much on the record.
Didn't she also say that it was a continuing course of conduct?
She did.
Was
yes,
that the appropriate standard? In findings, I was just clarifying. Was that the appropriate standard to apply in the findings?
Well, Your Honor, I think however she termed continuing course of conduct or how she related these prior acts to the charge acts, I think is supported by precedent. I would bring this court's attention to United States v. Thomas, and this was not a case cited in the brief. And for these cases that I am going to discuss, I will absolutely file a supplemental citation to authority after the oral argument. But in United States v. Thomas, this is a 1981 Court of Military Appeals case. The court explained that when focusing on the admission of uncharged misconduct and whether that uncharged misconduct requires an instruction, the focus is on the nexus between the uncharged and charged misconduct. And I'm going to quote a section of that opinion where the court says, "We have drawn a distinction for instructional purposes between uncharged misconduct, which is inextricably related, and uncharged misconduct, which lacks this nexus. Only for misconduct that lacks this nexus does the judge have some obligation to give an instruction on uncharged misconduct. And for evidence that is related, that has this close nexus, the court further explained that, observed from the standpoint of avoiding confusion of the court members, the admission of the evidence can be justified in terms of preventing a gap in the narrative of occurrences, a gap which might have induced unwarranted speculation by the members as to what had transpired, but had not been revealed to them." So this kind of goes to the judge's, military judge's explanation of continuing course of conduct, facts and circumstances. And Thomas supports the position that these pre-service acts were admissible to show everything that occurred between these individuals, to explain the context of the charged conduct and how it...
And keep going.
Yes, Your Honor. And how these were related, and to basically provide that picture so there was no narrative gap or gap in the narrative when the members were deciding this case. and for that reason, it's also not plain error, and also for additional reasons. First, the judge does not have a sua sponte duty to instruct on MRE 404B admitted evidence. MRE 105 puts the responsibility squarely on the parties to ask for limiting instructions. Here, trial defense counsel never requested such an instruction. In my discussion of Thomas, in terms of the lack of an instruction, was also followed by this court in United States versus Dagger. This is another case not cited to in the briefs, but this is a 1986 decision by this court. And in that case, this court found that the duty to sua sponte instruct should not necessarily apply where the uncharged misconduct is part of the chain of events that leads to the consummation of the crime charged. That was similarly followed in a 1993 opinion of this court in United States versus Anderson, and most recently in July of this year in United States versus Lozano. Here we have, and specifically in terms of the facts of this case as it relates to CL, we have references to prior oral sex that was inevitably admitted because in these messages, appellant requests on several occasions, on repeated occasions, for oral sex from CL. And in these requests, he references prior occasions. He says things like, I miss your mouth, and things like that, just to provide a little bit of context, excuse me.
So can context ever cross the line? Like, right, when is it facts and circumstances, and when is it just propensity? Like, what do you make of appellant's argument that getting into the details of the pre-service sexual interactions was a step too far?
Well, I think there is a line, Your Honor, and I'll discuss, I think there's a case that kind of can highlight where the line might be, and that's United States versus Burton. But before I move to Burton, I want to say that in this case, the line doesn't matter because defense counsel used these prior sexual acts in his defense. And this is another reason the court can find waiver and an intentional relinquishment of a known right, or at the very least, that the judge did not have a sua sponte duty to instruct because clearly trial defense counsel wanted to use this evidence. For example, as it relates to CL, trial defense counsel referred to some of these prior occasions of when she said oral sex occurred or did not occur, where she was, where appellant was, to highlight inconsistencies in her testimony and to paint her as a liar. One such occasion on cross-examination is on page 179 of the record. Also, trial defense counsel, in these Facebook messages in Prosecution Exhibit 3, trial defense counsel highlights Prosecution Exhibit 3 at page 206, and specifically this is a message where appellant sent CL a portion of the UCMJ. Apparently he got this training in either BMT or tech school about the age of consent, and he sends this to her and says something to the effect of, you know, nothing we did before can come back to haunt me. It's only the age of consent now. And for this reason, trial defense counsel used that to show, oh, he knew at the time that this was the age of consent. Therefore, there's no way he would have had sex with someone who's under 16. And as it relates to AS, defense counsel in opening statement and on cross-examination and in findings argument highlighted to the members that AS had sex with appellant, and her sexual maturity and hypersexual conversations — hypersexual is a term used by defense counsel — these hypersexual conversations instigated by AS would have led appellant to believe she was over 16 due to her maturity level and being able to understand and talk about these very sexual things. And the government was also, as Senior Judge Johnson pointed out, the government was also required to introduce evidence to prove every element of the offenses. And one of the elements, as it related to AS, that was in dispute was whether or not appellant knew her age. And that's why this conversation about appellant saying the youngest person he would have sex with is 12 is relevant in this case, because the question that was asked that prompted that response was asked by AS, and he said, "Is it weird being with me because I'm 14? And this is in the context of, "Is it weird having sex with me because I'm only 14? And appellant responded, "No, it's not, because I would go as young as 12. So that's why that was relevant in this case, to show knowledge or absence of mistake of fact as to age and as it related to AS. And also, for the reasons I previously mentioned, trial defense counsel wanted this evidence in to support his defense, which is clearly demonstrated by his opening statement. And even if this court finds that there was error, this court and CAF have recognized that a defense counsel may strategically not request a limiting instruction to prevent uncharged misconduct, from being emphasized. Two of the cases cited by the brief are Maynard and Ray, a 1980 CMA case. And also this court, as recently as 2015, recognized it in United States v. Griffin. And again, I'll provide these citations to the court following oral argument. But basically, these cases show that a defense counsel may strategically not object to the evidence or not request an instruction to prevent the 404B instruction. And I would point the court's attention to the Military Judges Bench Book, 2014, the official version, and view the 404B instruction. It states, the judge tells the members, you may rely on this evidence and use this evidence for its tendency, if any, to, and then it lists all the reasons why they may be relevant in helping the government prove the charged offenses. None of those reasons help the trial defense counsel. So it is obvious and is recognized by this court and precedent that a trial defense counsel may strategically not ask for that 404B instruction. And in this case, that would be a clear reason why, because defense counsel wanted to use this evidence. When evidence cuts both ways, it makes sense for an advocate to want to use the evidence but not get the instruction that erodes their use of the evidence or the way they want the members to view the evidence.
Captain Kellett, the cases you cited, I think Maynard and Griffin, was there a discussion on the record that the defense did not want an instruction where it would be very clear that they didn't want to highlight the issue, or was it something that the court read into the record based on the way the trial was litigated?
So I can't remember, I would have to double check Griffin, Your Honor, but in Maynard that was absolutely the case. But in this case, I would submit to the court that the distinction here is that trial defense counsel wanted to use this evidence as well. In that case, defense counsel objected to the introduction of the evidence and then stated, well, I'm not going to request an instruction because it's just going to highlight it. And they waived the request of the instruction. Here, we have trial defense counsel wanting to use the evidence. So an obvious or a reasonable inference from that be that trial defense counsel would not ask for instruction to not highlight evidence that they in fact want to use as well.
Counsel, what do you say to appellant's argument that trial counsel misused the evidence regarding 12-year-olds?
Well, misused the evidence trial counsel on several occasions in opening and findings highlighted to the to the members that he was not charged with these pre-service sexual acts, he's not on trial for them, and that he cannot be punished for them. This is during findings. And I would point, and this is, goes back to the United States v. Burton, which is a 2009 case cited in the brief, where trial counsel was found to have improperly invited members to convict based on criminal predisposition. Trial counsel explicitly asked them to compare the evidence in two different charges and find that he had a criminal predisposition to commit the charged offenses. In that case, there was no 413 instruction or anything like that. This was not a 413 case. CAF explicitly stated that. And CAF still found no plain error despite a trial counsel's request to the members to use propensity evidence to convict the appellant in that case. But CAF still found no plain error because there was no party that requested a limiting instruction based on trial counsel's request. Defense counsel never objected to the use of the evidence at trial or the admission of the evidence at trial. And they found that trial counsel's argument did not give rise for the military judge to sua sponte take remedial measures. Therefore, it was not plain and obvious that an additional instruction was wanted or needed. CAF did find that the general spillover instruction, which the military judge used in this case, was enough. So if you have a case where a trial counsel specifically asked the members to find that the appellant has a criminal predisposition and use that predisposition to find him guilty, but the spillover instruction is enough to overcome that, absolutely in this case there should be enough, it should be enough to find that there's no plain error because trial counsel never asked the members to find him guilty based on predisposition evidence. In fact, trial counsel was clear that they could not use it because he wasn't charged with it. And there was a general spillover instruction used in this case. So for those reasons, based on Burton, this court should find that there was no improper use of the evidence at trial by trial counsel.
Well, that addresses findings. It doesn't address sentencing, how they used it in sentencing.
So, Your Honor, as far as sentencing goes, I would, and again, this is a case not cited in the brief. I'll provide a citation to, but United States v. Norris, which is a 2011 CAF case. In that case, the government introduced evidence about other larcenies of property from a sheriff's office that appellant committed and that was not charged. It all happened prior to the charged offenses at trial. And the government tried to introduce these prior larcenies in sentencing as aggravation evidence under 1001 Bravo 4. CAF found that the evidence was admitted properly because it showed that the appellant had committed the same crime upon the same victim in the same place several times prior to the charged offenses. That's exactly what we have here. Even if this evidence was not charged or pre-service, it still would have came in sentencing as aggravating evidence under United States v. Norris. Because just like in Norris, it was admitted to show that the appellant committed the same crime upon the same victims, AS and CL, several times prior to the charged offenses in that case.
Captain Kellett, was it in fact a crime for appellant to do this when he was in high school and he was underage and he was not in the military?
So regardless of whether or not it was a crime, Your Honor, it was facts and circumstances and things that the appellant did prior to the charged offenses to show that he was manipulating them. He took this picture of her, used it, took this pre-service picture of CL and continued to use it against her.
So let's just take out the use of the coercion elements and just the fact that he would go as young as 12 in that statement. That was about age. That wasn't about coercion or manipulation. That was just his age preferences.
Well, as I mentioned, Your Honor, that wasn't used to show he was in findings, it wasn't used to show he had a criminal predisposition. It was used to show that he, in fact, knew her age based on the context of the entire conversation. Because the question was asked by AS, is it weird that you're having sex with me? These are not the exact words, but it was about the sexual acts they were having. Is it weird that I'm 14 and that you're with me? And he said no, because I would have sex with someone as young as 12. So while the while that may be a problem in sentencing for the for them to say that, you know, he was, for them to try to imply that he was having sex with 12-year-olds or that, or something like that would be a problem, but that's not what happened. It was used to just show that there was an absence as a mistake of fact as to A.S.'s age and findings. And the fact that this is brought up in sentencing is just aggravating evidence to show this is a strict liability crime, it's not strict liability, but this is a crime where intent is only important as to the appellant's knowledge of the individual's age. So we have appellant having sex with people that are under 16. So evidence that he knew that she was under 16 and still did it anyway, and that he sent a picture of the UCMJ saying, I know I can't have sex with you or therefore I'm not, and then he still does it, that's all aggravating, regardless of whether or not it was introduced in findings and if it was pre-service or during service. I'm moving on to the RCM 603 issue, the major change and minor change issue. First, the change does not increase the punishment or punitive exposure. It did not change the maximum punishment, and to the extent that evidence would be introduced as aggravating evidence, U.S. v. Norse, that I cited to you previously, would have allowed this evidence in sentencing anyway. Second, it does not change the nature or identity of the offense. The victims and the acts remained exactly the same, and defense was put on notice of these. The relevant portion of RCM 603 states that minor changes in charges and specifications are any except those which are likely to mislead the accused. And when reading RCM 603, I would ask the court to also consider Article 34, Charlie, which is the authority upon which RCM 603 is based. And in relevant part, Article 34C states, if the charges or specifications do not conform to the substance of the evidence contained in the report of the investigating officer, such changes as are needed to make them conform to the evidence may be made. And I would point the court's attention to the Foe Report, Volume 2 of the Foe Report. And this is the continuation page, page 2. And in that portion, the Foe, the preliminary hearing officer, stated, in order to keep the photo private, CO complied and performed oral sex on appellant on multiple occasions. She related that this occurred around September when he returned from boot camp, end quotes. This would ostensibly be September 2013. So the preliminary hearing officer noted in his report that this began, the extortions began in September of 2013.
Didn't the government know that then? When they referred the charges for the wrong date?
So the government absolutely, I mean, to the extent that there's actual notice, of course, I'm not sure, Your Honor, but absolutely there's constructive notice to the government and trial defense counsel. But that's exactly why 603 exists, Your Honor, to be able to correct these sorts of mistakes. These minor errors. And appellant's counsel said that there was no notice. And based on the Foe report and the reason for 603 and Article 34, Charlie, this is the exact reason why a minor change is permissible. There was notice. And also the evidence that was presented to the Foe also says, also demonstrates. I'm talking about Foe Exhibit 5, which is in Volume 3. This is towards the end of that exhibit. It's a report of investigation. And specifically, I'm talking about AFOSI agent notes of CL's interview. And I'm quoting where the agent wrote, from fall 2013 through mid-2014, victim performed oral sex on subject and was under the impression he would release photos. So again, not only does the Foe report state this, but also the evidence that was reviewed and provided to defense counsel show this. So the change was made to 27 October. The defense was on notice of the extortion beginning at least by September 2013, which encompasses the change.
But the government controls the specification, correct? So why didn't they make this change earlier then?
So I acknowledge that it would have probably been cleaner if it was done earlier, but the fact that it was changed at this point does not does not eliminate whether or not the defense was on notice. I mean, the defense was still on notice even if the change was made at trial.
So are there other cases that you can identify where a change was allowed this late in the proceedings after the conclusion of the government's case?
I don't know of any on hand, Your Honor, no. But I would point the court's attention to the fact that trial defense counsel, even at trial, demonstrated that he was aware that it began in 2013.
The trial defense counsel who objected to this as a major change?
Yes, Your Honor. While he did object that this was a major change, during trial he demonstrated that he knew that the extortions began prior to. An opening statement, he references from Facebook messages that happened outside the time period when he's talking about the extortion and his defense to the extortion. That, you know, there are some conversations that happen outside the charge time frame in opening statement. And also when he crosses the victim, CL, as it relates to the extortion, he clearly understands that the conversations began in 27 October 2013. And when he was provided these Facebook messages, you know, that he didn't ask for a continuance. He didn't ask for a motion to exclude any evidence that happened prior to the charge, the extortion charge. He didn't request a limiting instruction for that either. He was clearly aware of the state of the evidence based on the full report and the Facebook messages and made no objections prior to trial. So to the extent that there would be a notice issue, or to the extent that appellant's counsel argues that there's a notice issue, that's just simply not the case based on the record. And also, that's the first part of the, I believe it was Judge Lewis that asked about prejudice. Notice being the main point that appellant counsel addressed, but I just want to make sure it's clear that the crime did not contemplate anything new. The widening of the time frame did not contemplate anything new. It was the same victim, same act, it was the same photograph, same threat, and this was all known to the defense. And also, I believe appellant's counsel stated that describing the picture could have been, they didn't have to describe the picture in such detail during findings. But what was in the picture and what the picture showed was required to be described in detail to show the inherent coercive nature of appellant's threat to publicize the picture. So the fact that she's performing oral sex on him is required to show this is a very coercive threat that he's making to CL. If they just stated it was a picture, obviously that wouldn't be enough, but the nitty-gritty details of what the picture depicted were required to prove the charged offense of extortion.
How do you respond to appellant's argument that it changed the nature of the offense because of the inclusion of the in-person meeting with the expanded time frame?
Well, Your Honor, so to the extent that I believe that that's just an argument that there was provided lack of notice and trial counsel and that defense counsel at trial was surprised by this and had not heard of this before. But witnesses always, for whatever reason, change their testimony at trial or are inconsistent or say things they had never said before in pretrial interviews. What the focus should be is whether or not the defense was put on notice of this and whether or not the preliminary hearing officer reviewed this, considered it, and put it in his report so that the parties, it's clear to the parties that this was something that was considered. It was identified to trial defense counsel. So there was no surprise. And the fact that she may have stated that there wasn't in-person meeting, wasn't an in-person meeting, so that's why this had to be expanded, does not change the fact that he was put on notice.
Was the judge's analysis of this issue incomplete in that she identified this as a minor change but didn't go on to address whether there was actually prejudice, notwithstanding it being a minor change?
Well, Your Honor, I would, and just so that we're clear on what we're talking about as far as prejudice, I think the Caff's case and Caff's opinion, in Reese contemplates, when you're using the term prejudice, generally, under 603, the prior cases stated, well, if you find there's a major change, you still do a prejudice analysis. That's not the case anymore. If it's a major change, it's a major change in United States versus Reese. But I think what we're talking about is RCM 603, I believe it's subparagraph C.
I believe that is what we're talking about.
Right, so the term does not say prejudice, or the words are used are not prejudice, it's whether or not it affects a substantial right of the accused.
Counsel, I think it says right of the accused is prejudiced.
Oh, excuse me. So whether or not the rights of the accused are prejudiced, and the right in this case would be notice. There was no notice, there was no prejudice as it relates to notice. He was fairly informed and aware that this was the state of the evidence prior to trial.
But you'd agree that the trial judge did not, on the record, make a ruling on that prejudice?
No, Your Honor. She did not discuss in detail whether or not there was prejudice. She did reference the Army case, United States v. Witt, W-H-I-T-T, which found that a change of a year was not a major change. And she stated that she referenced that, and that case discussed prejudice, but she did not discuss prejudice on the record.
I have one more question, if that's okay. The Army's opinion in Stout discussed as part of its analysis that there was not a diverse occasions alleged, but in this case, diverse occasions is alleged. Do you see any distinction between that? Do you see any significance of the fact that the government alleged diverse occasions here?
Well, Your Honor, I think if we're talking about something that would include, for example, use of cocaine or something like that on diverse occasions, where it's a distinct different type of use and where it occurred may be an issue, or something like that, it may cause a problem, but in this case, no, because the way the threat was made was the same. What was being used to threaten or extort CL was the same picture, and obviously it was to CL, and the means of communication were all the same, that it would not cause a problem in this case. And I would also, and I see my time has run out, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
I would also say that this court, under its Article 66 powers, would still be able to look at the Facebook message and the evidence at trial to affirm a finding that is fairly included that is not a major change based on what was presented at trial. So even if this court finds that it cannot go all the way back to 27 October 2013, it can still find that the expansion or some portion of the expansion would fairly include the evidence at trial and not be a major change. And therefore, this court should also find that it was a minor change in the and a substantial right of the accused was not prejudiced. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appellant's counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have six points I'd like to make in rebuttal, if I can get through them. The first is that the court has heard a lot of cases that were not cited in the briefs. We don't think that you should consider those cases. We think you should consider the more recent cases that were cited, because insofar as there's a difference, the more recent decisions control. Those decisions are cases like Reynolds, that was decided in 1989, Barnett, decided in 2006, Diaz being a particularly important one because it says that the prosecution cannot use uncharged acts to disprove a defense that was never presented. Such evidentiary bootstrapping is not permitted. All of those are cited in the briefs, and they provide the proper standard, particularly the three-prong Reynolds analysis for the evaluation of this issue. Now, the government division has asserted waiver in four parts. The first is that the defense did not object to the prosecution's motion. Well, the prosecution's motion was a motion under 412, allowing this evidence despite the automatic exclusion that comes under 412 is a totally different thing from saying that it's admissible under 404B. Furthermore, the failure to object to the motion does not waive the issue. Same with the failure to object to the introduction of the evidence. This is not an issue, like you saw in Ahern, where there is a procedural rule that applies a procedural waiver. This is an issue in a situation where it's well settled that the mere failure to object does not constitute a waiver. It constitutes a forfeiture, leading to the plain error test.
Well, didn't the government's filing, though, refer to MRE 404B as why it should be permitted, what its relevance is going to be?
So they did, Your Honor. They certainly referred to it, but the 404B issue was never litigated, and in the end, what defense counsel acknowledged was not that it was ever admissible to explain the facts and circumstances. Rather, the government division's own brief at page 8 quotes the trial defense counsel as saying, it was only ever admissible for the purpose of showing his knowledge as to their age. And that's quoting the record at 413 to 414. And so there was never, if there's going to be an affirmative waiver, right, if the defense counsel has intentionally relinquished a known right of the accused without doing the Alano analysis of what right, I mean, they've never identified the right at stake. They don't agree that the right at stake is the constitutional right that we've identified. So we're not sure what right has been waived. But if there's a right that has been waived, there's got to be some indication of it in the record. And all we see is the defense saying, yeah, it was admissible to show knowledge as to age, which for one of them just wasn't an issue. It didn't matter at all. And for the other one, it doesn't prove, for AS, the fact that appellant had had sexual activity with her does not prove he knew her age. And the fact of the sex doesn't prove he knows that she's under 16. So it's just not probative to that issue. The issue of when CL performed oral sex on appellant in service as a triggering mechanism or a tie-down point for the extortion charge, in the prosecution's opening statement, and this is addressed in our brief at page 7, our initial brief, the trial counsel said that CL would testify about, quote, oral sex with appellant when she was 15 years old in the summer and early part of 2014. Now, government division counsel has conceded that the defense was surprised. The prosecution was surprised, too. Everybody was surprised. Yes, there was some pre-trial indication of 2013, but if you look at the testimony of CLNAS on direct examination, it begins with an orientation, a pages-long orientation for each of them of, okay, how old are you now? How old were you last year? Let's walk back to your freshman year in high school, and what year was that, to get everybody on the same page of the years, because it gets confusing, especially for young people. So her earlier statements about 2013, not even the trial counsel believed that's what was going to get presented at trial. Certainly not the defense, and we think that the surprise is the prejudice. You can't on one hand say the defense has notice, but on the other hand say, but they were surprised. You don't get surprised by something you know about. The next point I'd like to make is the argument about the inherently coercive nature of the image. Right? So the image was, the defense conceded that the image once existed, but the defense's position was the image had been deleted and CL knew it was deleted. The image was a picture of CL performing oral sex on appellant. Insofar as the prosecution might be able to say, hey, this is an especially coercive image because it shows you doing it to him as opposed to showing you doing it to anyone, just an image of oral sex, don't say who it's with, or just an embarrassing image. Insofar as you have to draw that all the way out, that was not placed in issue, and that's where Diaz comes in. The defense didn't say, this picture wasn't that bad, you didn't care about it. The defense acknowledged there was a picture, she didn't like it, she was unhappy with it, she told him to delete it, he deleted it, and it was never seen again, and she knew it. That was their position. And that's what could have been rebutted, but it's not what they rebutted. I also want to briefly address sort of what we really think is the unspoken issue in this case, which is the change from civilian to airman. Right? Appellant went through a major change in his life and his personality and his perspective in August, September, October of 2013. His defense at trial was that changed him. After that, He did not have sexual contact with CL anymore. He didn't, fool around with this image anymore. He didn't do any of these things because he knew she was under 16 and he knew it was prohibited. With AS, he didn't know that. So yes, he continued to have contact with her, but he wouldn't have had he known she was under 16, just like he didn't with CL. And I'll briefly turn to, ask the court to take a look at our initial brief on page 12, which addresses all of the other factors about CL that they pointed to say this is why he didn't know her age. Seeing that my time has expired, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.